Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Larry Zimmerman helped build the anthropology program and the archaeology lab during his 22 years at the University of South Dakota. On Tuesday, March 26th, has him back on campus, only this time he's lecturing on the role South Dakota has in national and international developments in archaeology. This presentation is free, it's open to the public, and it's inside Farber Hall beginning at 4 p.m. Central Time. Larry Zimmerman joins us on the phone now from Indianapolis. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Glad to be here.
So a lot of people look at archaeology and think this is the study of the past, and maybe it doesn't reflect much about who we are. It really tells us mostly about who we were, but that's not the whole story, is it?
Oh, definitely not. A lot of people have a really powerful misconception about archaeology is that it has to do just with stuff in the very ancient past, but archaeology has changed a lot in the last few decades. One of the things that we realize now is that archaeology can tell us some things about present-day life, the kinds of things that people don't normally consider. Archaeology is really about stuff. It's about things that people do and how they use them and what they mean to them and so forth. And a lot of archaeologists are now trending to look at those kinds of studies in their research, not just the very ancient past.
And tell us a little bit about how some of the, you know, just the rules of engagement or the how we look at the things that we are finding has also evolved and shifted.
Well, one of the things that has happened over the years is that especially when archaeology became a discipline, archaeology was pretty much a colonial discipline. It tended to look at people from the countries that the U.S., England, and others were so heavily involved in and looked at the past that those people had, thinking that they would probably disappear in the future or become acculturated and the like, and it became very exploitative. What happened is that people in archaeology hardly ever ask for permission to study people and the like, very much like the whole discipline of anthropology in that regard. And since then, we've become much more conscious of the kinds of things that archaeology has done to alienate people, the misconceptions that we have promulgated to the general public about the people of the past. And now we're trying to do things in a much, much more collaborative kind of way as partners with the people that we study.
How do you rebuild some of that trust? Because that colonial past certainly lingers and people are very much aware of it.
It's tough. A lot of Native Americans, for example, have some real beefs about archaeologists. Archaeologists, for example, have dug graves, studied the materials in the graves and so forth. And one of the things that we did in archaeology, and this is one of the places where South Dakota was very prominent, was to try to get archaeologists to say, hey, wait a minute, let's not do that kind of thing anymore. Let's try to be sure that people know how and why we're studying things, to get their permissions, to even say some things to us about what they do and don't want us to tell. And it's taken a long time for that to happen. It started really in a strong way back in the late 1960s when the American Indian Movement was disrupting archaeological digs around the country. And then that kind of calmed down for a little while because they got so heavily involved in some other activities. But in the later 70s, people began to get very concerned about archaeologists digging graves and started pushing for a lot of different kinds of legislation, especially in the state of Iowa, right next door. In fact, a Yankton Sioux woman, Maria Pearson, was probably the first person to actually push archaeology to try to do some things about the way they were approaching treatment of human remains. And then that kind of took off, and a lot of people around the world started seeing that. And USD was right in the thick of things because of the work that we had done on the Crow Creek Massacre site. That particular site was found in the late 1970s, and it had the remains of about 500 people that were recovered as part of the project. The site was eroding into the reservoir on Lake Francis Case. And we agreed right up front to actually repatriate and rebury those remains before we even did the study. And that was quite a shock to a lot of Indian people, I think, that we would agree to that. And it was an even greater shock to a lot of the anthropologists who didn't want us to do that. And from there, that got us a reputation of people who would be willing to work with Indians. And it brought some of the world's attention to us as well.
Mm. What was driving that, you know, in South Dakota? Was it just a conversation about ethics? Was it, you know, conversations with Native archaeologists? Was it just an awareness? Why be ahead of our time? What was driving it?
At that point in time, Laurie, there were very few Native archaeologists at all.
Yeah.
In fact, at that point in time, I could count maybe five people with archaeology PhDs who were Native. Most people avoided archaeology. What really pushed us to do it was the fact that we were able to see with the remains that we were working with how there were so many issues of sacredness, of concern about what was going on in terms of the spiritual impact on the lives of the people on the Crow Creek Sioux Reservation, the Arikara people who were now in North Dakota but whose lands were right there nearby on the Crow Creek, what's now the Crow Creek Reservation. And it was an awareness that the complaints were not about some kind of identity politics or something like that, but about real concern about what we were doing and how it was impacting their daily lives and the way they saw the world. And so it became an ethics issue in one sense, and we kind of worked from there.
And then talk a little bit about what you said earlier about this notion of what do they want us to tell and what do they not want us to tell. That sounds particularly like a rich ethical conversation as far as sharing the knowledge of what you might find out and how that knowledge is shared.
Yeah.
Wow.
it is really tough. One thing that's very difficult, for example, is just the way museums and some institutions have had archaeological remains sitting on their shelves for years and years, especially human remains, and not even studying them. And that was often the case in South Dakota during the 40s to the early 60s with the River Basin surveys that tried to locate archaeological sites that were being covered by the water of the reservoirs that were being built. So that was one sort of thing. The other thing is just as I said, museums putting things on display, and it wasn't uncommon to walk into a museum and see Native American ancestral remains on display there. And that's really bothersome to people. And it's not even just the human remains. Sometimes it's sacred objects that have been taken, put on display, and so forth. So we were hearing those kinds of things from people quite often. But then there's also some things that people have heard that they really disagree with. For example, there are some things about, say, sexually transmitted disease that have been waffled about by Europeans versus Native Americans, and where certain diseases came from, and who had them first and transmitted them, and all that sort of thing. And those kinds of things become very difficult for people to hear, especially when they're on the negative receiving side of that. I guess it also is a matter of who gets to tell the story. Mm. If you think about that for a minute, if you think about 9/11, for example, and the events that happened there in New York City and Washington, D.C. and Pennsylvania in the field there, who should tell that story? Would we be comfortable if somebody from, say, Al-Qaeda told that story, which, of course, they did? Their story would be a very different story from the kinds of things that we would tell or want to tell about it. And sometimes it was the same way with the way archaeologists and anthropologists would tell the story of Native Americans or other indigenous people. The story didn't come out the way they thought it should. And so it's useful to find out what their concerns are and sometimes tell a different story.
Talk about looting and sabotaging of sites and some of the history of and the problems with that.
Looting has been going on for generations. In South Dakota, one of the major places that people have looted, of course, is along the reservoirs. The Missouri River, at one point in time, was called one of the four greatest archaeological regions in the country. And there were so many archaeological sites there that were flooded by the reservoir and were going to be inundated or washed out. And people would go up and down the river, and they would see archaeological remains coming out of the reservoir walls on the banks along the walls, and they would get their shovel out or whatever, and they would dig away and find things and take them back and put them in their collections. Archaeologists don't have a problem with people collecting things as long as it's done ethically and as long as it's done within the law. And a lot of the things along the reservoir, of course, because it's federally controlled land, or in many cases Native American land right along that as well, the people who collect there, who pick up things, are violating federal law and don't even realize it. One of the things I'll be talking about a bit is a case that I've been working on recently with the FBI here in Indiana, in which a man had been going out for decades out into South Dakota, but other places in the world as well. Every time he would go out, he would dig. And he dug quite a number of Native American remains up, both in the Southwest and in South Dakota. And the FBI caught wind of his collection down in this small town in, south of Indianapolis. And they actually did a raid on the site and found out that he had the remains of at least 500 individuals in his collection. I was part of that consulting with the FBI. One of the things that I opened up in a bag in one of his areas that had been wet and moldy and everything else was a bag of skulls. And they were not processed at all. It was in a big black garbage bag, but inside that were some paper bags. And inside one of the paper bags, for example, I found a cash register receipt from a grocery store in Mobridge from the 1960s. Hmm. And it's those sorts of things happen all the time.
We just have about a minute left, and my question is, why? You know, to what end? Is this like a novel collection, or is there a market?
There is both artifact trafficking, uh-huh. the sale of artifacts, and that's one of the biggest problems the FBI actually faces on an international level besides terrorism and drug trafficking. But there's also, in the case of this man, he had 40,000 objects in his entire collection. That's what I would call archaeological hoarding.
Right. Larry Zimmerman helped build the anthropology program and the archaeology lab at the University of South Dakota Tuesday, March 26th, has him back on campus, only this time he's lecturing on the role South Dakota has in national and international developments in archaeology. That's inside Farber Hall. It begins at 4 p.m. Central on Tuesday. Larry Zimmerman, so fascinating. Thank you so much for being here. Come back anytime with more stories about this.
I'd be pleased to do that.